best I've ever had.
Richard realized that his fingers were empty. He thought that he must have eaten the scoop of rice until he saw the white splat on the tray under him. She plucked an egg from the bowl, pressed her red lips around it, and bit it in half.
Mmm, luscious.
She placed the round end of the other half to his lips.
Here, try it.
Its silken surface had a mildly spicy tang against his tongue, and a flexible, resilient feel. She pushed it all the way in with one finger. It was chew or choke. He chewed. Her gaze left his to roam the tray.
What have we here? Oh, Richard, don't tell me it's...
She swirled her first and second fingers around the bowl with the pears. She sucked the thick white sauce off her first finger. Some of the coating on the other dribbled down her hand to her wrist.
Oh, yes. Oh, Richard, this is fabulous. Here.
She put her second finger up to his lips. Before he realized it, she had the whole length in his mouth.
Suck it clean, she insisted. Isn't that the best you've ever had?
Richard nodded, trying to catch his breath after she drew her finger out. She tilted her wrist.
Oh, please, lick it off before it gets on my dress.
He took her hand up in his and put it to his mouth. The taste of her galvanized him. His lips on her flesh made his heart pound painfully. She let out a throaty laugh.
That tickles. Your tongue is rough.
He let her hand go, rousing from the intimate connection.
Sorry,
he whispered.
Don't be silly. I didn't say I didn't like it.
Her eyes found his. Lamplight glowed softly on one side of her face, firelight on the other. He envisioned raking his fingers through her hair. Her breaths were the mate of his.
I did like it, Richard.
So did he. The room seemed to be spinning. The sound of his name on her lips sent waves of euphoria coursing through him. With the greatest of effort, he forced himself to stand.
Catherine, it's late, and I'm really tired.
She rose willingly, eagerly, a graceful movement that betrayed her shape through the silken dress. His control threatened to unravel completely as she slipped her arm around his, pressing close.
Show me which room is yours.
He could feel her firm breast crushed against his arm as he led her out into the hall. Ulrich and Egan stood not far away with their arms folded. Farther off at each end of the hall, Kara and Reyna came to their feet. None of the four showed any reaction to his having Catherine on his arm. Richard said nothing to them as he headed for the guest rooms. With urgent insistence, Catherine's free hand stroked his shoulder. The heat of her flesh against him warmed him to his bones. He didn't know if his legs would make the journey. When he found the wing with the guest rooms, he gestured Ulrich and Egan close.
Take shifts. I want one of you on watch at all times. I don't want anyone or anything coming into this hall tonight.
He glanced to the two Mordsith waiting at the far end.
That includes them.
They asked no questions and vowed it would be so before they planted themselves. Richard took Catherine halfway down the hall. She was still caressing his arm. Her breast was still pressed against it.
I trust this room will do.
Her lips parted as her chest heaved. Her delicate fingers clutched at his shirt.
Yes, she whispered in a pant. This room.
Richard summoned every ounce of strength.
I'll take the one right next to it. You'll be safe here.
What? The blood drained from her face.
Oh, please, Richard.
Sleep well, Catherine. She tightened her grip on his arm.
But you have to come in. Oh, please, Richard, I'll be afraid.
He squeezed her hand as he took it from his arm.
Your room is safe, Catherine. Don't be concerned.
There could be something inside waiting. Please, Richard, come in with me.
Richard smiled reassuringly.
There's nothing inside. I could sense it if there were danger anywhere near. I'm a wizard, remember. You're perfectly safe, and I'll be only a few steps away. Nothing will disturb your rest, I swear it.
He opened the door, handed her a lamp off a bracket beside the door, and put a hand to the small of her back, urging her in. She turned and ran a finger down the center of his chest.
I'll see you tomorrow.
He took her hand from his chest and kissed it in as courtly a fashion as he could muster.
Count on it. We have a lot of work to do first thing tomorrow.
He pulled her door closed and then went to the next. The two Mordsith's eyes never left him. He watched as they slid their backs down the wall to sit on the floor. Each folded her legs, as if to say they intended to be there all night, and each gripped her Aegil in both hands. Richard glanced at the door to Catherine's room, his gaze lingering a long moment. The little voice in the back of his head was screaming frantically. He rested, opened the door to his room. Inside, he laid his face against the closed door as he caught his breath. He compelled himself to throw the bolt. He sank down on the edge of the bed, putting his face in his hands. What was the matter with him? His shirt was soaked with sweat. Why should he be having such thoughts about this woman? But he was. Dear spirits, he was. He remembered that the Sisters of the Light thought men suffered from uncontrollable urges. With dazed effort, he drew the Sword of Truth from its scabbard, sending its soft, clear ring around the dark room. Richard planted the point on the floor and with both hands held a hilt to his forehead, letting the wrath inundate him. He felt its fury storm through his soul and hoped it would be enough. From a dim corner of his mind, Richard knew he was in a dance with death, and this time his sword couldn't save him. He also knew he had no choice. Chapter 21 Sister Philippa made the most of her already ample height as she stiffened her back while managing to look down her thin, straight nose without making it seem as if she were really looking down her nose, but she was.
"Surely, prelate, you have not considered this matter thoroughly enough. Perhaps if you were to reflect on it a bit more, you would realize that 3,000 years of results attests to the need."
With her elbow on the table, Verna rested her chin in the heel of her loose fist while scanning through a report, making it impossible to look at her without seeing the gold, sunburst-patterned ring of office. She glanced up just to make sure Sister Philippa was, in fact, looking at her.
"Thank you, sister, for your wise advice. But I have already considered the matter at length. There is no need to put any more digging into a dry well. It just makes you thirstier, which raises your hopes, but not any water."
Sister Philippa's dark eyes and exotic features rarely showed emotion, but Verna detected a tightening in the muscles in her narrow jaw.
"But, prelate, we won't be able to ascertain if a young man is progressing properly, or has learned enough to be released from his Radahan. It's the only way."
Verna grimaced at the report she was reading. She set it aside for later action and gave her full attention to her advisor.
"How old are you, sister?"
Sister Philippa's dark gaze didn't waver.
479, prelate.
Verna had to admit to herself that she felt a bit of envy. The woman looked hardly older than she, yet she was, in fact, on the order of 300 years older. The 20-odd years away from the palace's spell had cost Verna time she could never recover. She would never have the lifespan to learn what this woman would.
"How many of those years at the Palace of the Prophets?"
470, prelate.
The inflection on the title was hard to detect. Unless one had been listening for it, Verna had been listening.
"So you are saying, then, that the Creator has granted you a span of 470 years to learn his work, to work with and teach young men to control their gift and become wizards, and in all that time, you have failed to be able to come to a determination of the nature of your students?"
"Well, no, prelate, that's not exactly what.
Are you trying to tell me, sister, that a whole palace full of Sisters of the Light are not smart enough to determine if a young man, who has been under our charge and tutelage for near to 200 years, is ready for advancement, without subjecting him to a brutal test of pain? You have so little faith in the sisters, in the Creator's wisdom in choosing us to do his work. Are you trying to tell me that the Creator chose us, gave us, collectively, thousands of years of experience, and we are still too stupid to do the work? I think that perhaps the prelate is permission denied. It's an obscene use of the Radahan, giving that kind of pain. It can tear the fabric of a person's mind. Why, young men have even died in the test.
You go tell those sisters that I expect them to come up with a strategy for accomplishing the task without blood, vomit, or screaming. You might even suggest they try something revolutionary like, oh, I don't know, maybe talking to the young men? Unless the sisters think they would be outwitted, in which case I would like them to admit as much to me in a report for the record."
Sister Philippa stood silent a moment, probably considering the worth of further arguing. Reluctantly, she at last bowed.
"Very wise, prelate. Thank you for enlightening me."
She turned to leave, but Verna called her back.
"Sister, I know how you feel. I was taught the same as you and believed as you. A young man of a mere 20-odd years taught me how wrong I had been. Sometimes the Creator chooses to bring his light to us in ways we don't expect, but he does expect us to be ready to receive his wisdom when it's presented to us."
"You speak of young Richard."
Verna picked with a thumbnail at the disorderly edges in the stack of reports awaiting her attention.
"Yes,"
she abandoned her official tone.
"What I learn, Philippa, is that these young men, these wizards, are going to be sent out into a world that will test them. The Creator wants us to determine if we have taught them to endure with integrity the pain they will see and feel."
She tapped her chest.
"In here. We must determine if they can make the painful choices the Creator's light sometimes requires. That is the meaning of the test of pain. Their ability to endure torture tells us nothing of their heart, their courage, or their compassion.
You yourself, Philippa, have passed the test of pain. You would have fought to be prelate. You've worked for hundreds of years toward the goal of being at least in serious contention. Events cheated you out of that chance. Yet you have never said one bitter word to me, though you must feel the pain every time you look at me. Instead, you have done your best to advise me in the post, and have worked in the interest of the palace despite that pain. Would I be better served had I insisted you be tested by torture to become my adviser? Would that have proven anything? Sister Philippa's cheeks had mantled. I won't lie by pretending to agree with you. But at least I now understand that you have indeed been shoveling dirt out of the hole, and are not simply abandoning it as dry because you didn't want to sweat. I will carry out your directive at once, Verna. Verna smiled. Thank you, Philippa. Philippa betrayed the slightest hint of a smile.
Richard created quite an upheaval around here. I thought he was going to try to kill us all, and he turns out to have been a greater friend to the palace than any wizard in 3,000 years.
Verna barked a laugh. If you only knew how many times I had to pray for the strength not to strangle him. As Philippa left, Verna could see through the door into the outer office that Millie was awaiting permission to enter and do the cleaning. Verna stretched with a yawn, picked up the report she had set aside, and went to the door. She waved Millie into her office as she turned her attention to her two administrators, Sister Dulcinea and Phoebe. Before Verna could speak, Sister Dulcinea stood with a stack of reports.
If you're ready, prelate, we have these in order for you.
Verna took the stack, about the weight of an infant, and rested it on a hip.
Yes, all right, thank you. It's late. Why don't you two be off?
Sister Phoebe shook her head.
I don't mind, prelate. I enjoy the workin', and tomorrow is another long day of it. I won't have you nodding off because you don't get enough sleep. Now be off, the both of you.
Phoebe scooped up a sheaf of papers, probably to take to her own office so she could continue working. Phoebe seemed to think that they were in a paper race. Whenever she suspected there was even a remote chance Verna might actually catch up, she worked frantically, producing more of the stuff, almost as if by magic. Dulcinea plucked her cup of tea from the desk, leaving the papers. She worked at a measured pace, never lowering herself to scrambling to stay ahead of Verna, but she still managed to produce stacks of reports, sorted and annotated, almost at will. Neither needed to fear that Verna would catch up with them. Every day set her further behind. Both sisters bade their farewells, offering their hope that the Creator would grant the prelate a restful sleep. Verna waited until they had reached the outer door.
"Oh, Sister Dulcinea, I have a little matter I'd like you to take care of tomorrow."
"Of course, prelate. What is it?"
Verna placed the report she had brought on Dulcinea's desk, where it would be the first thing she would see when she sat down in the morning. "A request for support from a young woman and her family. One of our young wizards is to be a father." Phoebe squealed.
"Oh, that's wonderful. We pray that, with the Creator's blessing, it will be a boy and have the gift. There hasn't been one born with a gift in the city since, well, I can't even remember the last time. Maybe this time."
Verna's scowl finally brought her to silence. Verna turned her attention to Sister Dulcinea. "I want to see this young woman and the young man responsible for her condition. Tomorrow you will arrange an appointment. Perhaps her parents should be there as well, since they are requesting assistance." Sister Dulcinea, a blank expression on her face, leaned in a little.
"Is there a problem, prelate?"
Verna hiked the load of reports up higher on her hip.
"I should say there is. One of our young men got the woman pregnant."
Sister Dulcinea set her tea down on the corner of the desk as she took a step closer.
"But, prelate, we allow our charges to go into the city for this very reason. It not only lets them dissipate their impulses so they may devote themselves to their studies, but it also, on occasion, nets us one with the gift."
"I will not sanction the palace meddling in creation and the lives of innocent people." Sister Dulcinea's blue eyes glanced the length of Verna's simple dark blue dress.
"Prelate, men have uncontrollable urges."
"So do I. But with the Creator's help, I've so far managed not to strangle anyone."
Phoebe's laugh was cut short by a scalding glance from Sister Dulcinea.
"Prelate, men are different. They can't control themselves. Allowing this simple diversion keeps their minds focused on their lessons. The palace can well afford the recompense. It's a small price to pay in view of the fact that it, on occasion, results in gaining us a young wizard."
"The charge of the palace is to teach our young men to use their gift in a responsible fashion, with restraint, and knowing full well the consequences of wielding their ability. When we encourage them to act in the exact opposite fashion with regard to other aspects of their lives, it undermines our teachings. As to the occasional result of one with the gift being born from these indiscriminate couplings,
There is no evidence that it's of benefit. Who is to say that, were they to act with more responsibility and control, the results of meaningful couplings in their future wouldn't produce more than a dismal percentage of offspring with the gift? For all we know, their lascivious indiscretion could be diluting their ability to pass on the gift.
Or developing it to its highest chances, poor though they are. Verna shrugged.
Perhaps. But I do know that those fishermen out on the river don't spend their entire lives fishing the exact same spot because they once caught a fish there. Since we are netting few fish, I think it's time for us to move on.
Sister Dulcinea clasped her hands in an effort to be patient.
Prelate, the Creator blessed people with their nature such as it is, and there is no way we can alter it. Men and women are going to go on doing what gives them pleasure. Of course they are. But as long as we pay the cost of the results, we encourage more of it. If there are no consequences, then there will be no self-control. How many children have grown up without the benefit of a father because we give pregnant young women gold? Does that gold replace nurturing? How many lives have we altered to their detriment with our gold?
Dulcinea spread her hands in dismay.
Our gold helps them. Our gold encourages the women in the city to act irresponsibly and to bed our young men because it means a life of support without qualifications.
Verna swept her free hand around, indicating the city.
We are demeaning these people with our gold. We have rendered them little more than breeding stock. But we have used this method for thousands of years to help augment those with the gift we can find. Hardly any with the gift are born anymore. I realize that. But we're in the business of teaching people, not breeding them. Our gold reduces them to creatures acting out of want of gold instead of people having a child out of love.
Sister Dulcinea was stricken mute for only a moment.
How can we be seen as so heartless as to deny the help of a little of our gold? Lives are more important than gold. I've seen the reports. It's hardly a little amount of gold, but that's beside the point. The point is that we are breeding our Creator's fellow children like livestock, and in so doing, we are breeding contempt for values. But we teach our young men values. As the Creator's highest creation, people respond to the teaching of values because they have the intellect to understand its importance.
Verna sighed.
Sister, suppose we preached truthfulness and at the same time gladly handed out a penny for each lie told. What do you venture would be the result?
Sister Phoebe covered her mouth as she laughed.
I'd venture we'd soon be penniless.
Sister Dulcinea's blue eyes were ice.
I didn't realize you were so heartless, prelate, as to let the Creator's newborn children go hungry. The Creator gave their mothers breasts, so they might suckle their children, not so they could wile gold from the palace.
Sister Dulcinea's face went crimson.
But men have uncontrollable urges. Verna's voice lowered with heat. The only time a man's urges are truly uncontrollable is when a sorceress casts a glamour. No sister has cast a glamour spell over any of the women in the city. Need I remind you that were a sister to do so, she would be lucky to be put out of the palace, if not hanged. As well you know, a glamour is the moral equivalent to rape.
Dulcinea's face had gone white.
I'm not saying, Verna glanced to the ceiling and thought. As I recall, the last time a sister was caught casting a glamour was, what, 50 years ago?
Sister Dulcinea's gaze sought refuge but found none.
It was a novice, prelate, not a sister.
Verna kept her glare on Dulcinea.
You were on the tribunal, as I also recall, Dulcinea nodded. And you voted to hang her, a poor young woman who had only been here for a few brief years, and you voted to put her to death. It's the law, prelate, she said without looking up. It is the maximum of the law. Others voted the same as I?
Verna nodded.
Yes, they did. A tie. 6-6. Prelate Annalena broke the deadlock by voting to have the young woman banished.
Sister Dulcinea's penetrating blue eyes finally came up.
I still say she was wrong. Baldura vowed undying vengeance. She swore to destroy the palace of the prophets. She spat in the prelate's face and promised someday to kill her.
Verna wrinkled her brow.
I always wondered, Dulcinea, why you were selected to be on the tribunal.
Sister Dulcinea swallowed.
Because I was her instructor.
Really? Her teacher? Verna clicked her tongue.
Where do you suppose the young woman ever learned to cast a glamour?
The color returned to Sister Dulcinea's face in a rush.
We were never able to establish that with certitude. Probably her mother. A mother often teaches a young sorceress such things. Yes, I've heard that.
But I wouldn't know. My mother wasn't gifted. She was a skip. Your mother was gifted, if I recall.
Yes, she was.
Sister Dulcinea kissed her ring finger while whispering a prayer to the Creator, a private act of supplication and devotion done frequently, but rarely in front of others.
It's getting late, Prelate. We don't wish to keep you any longer.
Verna smiled.
Yes. Good night, then.
Sister Dulcinea bent in a formal bow.
As you command, Prelate, tomorrow I will see to the matter of the pregnant woman and young wizard, after I clear it with Sister Leoma.
Verna lifted an eyebrow.
Oh? And now Sister Leoma outranks the prelate, yes?
Well, no, prelate,
Sister Dulcinea stammered.
It's just that Sister Leoma likes me to... I just thought you would want me to inform your advisor of your action so that she would not be caught unawares.
Sister Leoma is my advisor, sister. I will inform her of my actions if I deem it necessary.
Phoebe's round face tilted from one woman to the other as she silently watched the exchange.
As you wish, prelate, it will be done, Sister Dulcinea said. Please forgive my enthusiasm in assisting my prelate.
Verna shrugged as best she could with a load of reports.
Of course, sister. Good night.
Thankfully, they both departed without further argument. Grumbling to herself, Verna lugged the stack of reports into her office and dumped them on her desk beside the ones she had yet to get to. She eyed Millie, off in a corner, scrubbing with a rag at a spot no one would ever see were it to be left there for the next 100 years. The dimly lit office was silent, but for the swishing of Millie's rag and her mumbling to herself under her breath. Verna ambled over to the bookcase near where the woman was on her knees working, and ran a finger along the volumes without really seeing the gold-leafed titles on the worn spines of the ancient leather covers.
"How are your old bones tonight, Millie?"
"Oh, don't get me started, prelate, or I'll soon have your hands all over me trying to heal what can't be healed. Age, you know."
Her knee nudged the bucket closer as her hand moved on to scrub at another place on the carpet.
"We all get old. The Creator himself must have intended it, as no mortal can heal it. Though I've had more time than most are granted, working here in the palace, I mean."
Her tongue poked out of the corner of her mouth as she applied more force to the rag.
"Yes, the Creator has blessed me with more years than I know what to do with."
Verna had never seen the sinewy little woman in anything other than a resolute state of movement. Even when she spoke, her rag constantly wiped dust, or a thumb rubbed at a spot, or a nail picked at a crust of dirt no one else could see. Verna pulled out a volume and opened it.
"Well, I know that Prelate Annalena appreciated having you around all those years."
"Oh, yes, many years it was. My many years.
A prelate, I'm coming to discover, has precious little opportunity for friendship. It was good that she had yours. I'm sure I'll find no less comfort in having you around."
Millie mumbled a curse at a reluctant bit of dirt.
"Oh, yes, we had many a talk late into the night. My, but she was a wonderful woman, wise and kind. Why, she would listen to anyone, even old Millie."
Verna smiled as she absently turned a page in the book, a volume on the arcane laws of a long-dead kingdom.
"It was so good of you to help her with her ring and the letter, I mean."
Millie looked up, a grin coming to her thin lips. Her hand had actually stopped wiping.
"Ah, so you'll be wanting to know about that, like all the others?"
Verna snapped the book closed.
"Others? What others?"
Millie dunked her rag in the soapy water.
"The sisters. Leoma, Dulcinea, Marin, Philippa, those others. You know them, I'm sure."
She licked the end of a finger and rubbed it on the bottom of the dark woodwork, squeaking off a spot.
"There might have been a few more, I don't recall. Age, you know. They all came to me after the funeral. Not together, mind you,"
she said with a chuckle.
"You know, each alone, their eyes watching the shadows as they asked the same as you."
Verna had forgotten her pretense at the bookcase.
"And what did you tell them?"
Millie wrung her rag.
"The truth, of course. Same as I'll tell you, if you've a mind to hear it."
"Yes," Verna said, reminding herself to keep the edge out of her voice.
"Since I'm the prelate now and all, I think I should hear about it. Why don't you rest a bit and tell me the story?"
With a grunt of ache, Millie struggled to her feet and turned her sharp eyes on Verna.
"Why, thank you, prelate. But I've got work to do, you know. I wouldn't want you thinking I'm a slacker, seeking to work my tongue instead of my rag."
Verna patted the wiry woman's shoulder.
"No fear of that, Millie. Tell me about Prelate Annalena."
"Well, now, she was on her deathbed when I saw her. I cleaned Nathan's rooms, too, you know, so that's when I saw her, when I went to Nathan's. The prelate trusted no one but me to go in there with that man. Can't say as I blame her, though the prophet was always kind to me. Except when he would go off about something or another, yelling, you know. Well, not at me, understand, but at his condition and all, being locked in his apartments for all those years. Takes a toll on a man, I suppose.
Verna cleared her throat. I imagine it was difficult for you to see the prelate in such a condition. Millie put a hand to Verna's arm.
Don't you just know it? Broke my heart, it did. But she was in her usual kind humor, despite the pain.
Verna was biting the inside of her lip.
You were telling me about the ring and the letter?
Oh, yes.
Millie squinted, then reached out and picked a bit of lint from the shoulder of Verna's dress.
You should let me brush this out for you. It doesn't do to have people think.
Verna took the woman's calloused hand.
Millie, this is a bit important to me. Could you please tell me about how you came to have the ring?
Millie smiled apologetically.
Anne told me she was dying. Said it right out, she did. Millie, I'm dying. Well, I was in tears. She had been my friend for a good long time. She smiled and took my hand, just like you have it now, and told me that she had one last task she wished me to do. She pulled her ring off her finger and handed it to me. In my other hand, she put that letter sealed with wax and imprinted with a sunburst off the ring. She told me how, when her funeral was going on, I should put the ring on top of the letter, on the pedestal I was to take in there. She told me to be careful not to touch the ring to the letter until just at the end, or the magic she had put around it could kill me. She warned me several times to remember to be careful not to touch them together until I did it all proper. She told me just what to do in what order, so that's what I done. I never saw her again after she gave me the ring.
Verna stared off out the open doors to the garden she had never had time to visit.
When was this?
That's a question none of the others asked,
Millie mumbled to herself. She stroked a thin finger back and forth across her lower lip.
Let's see now. Quite a while back it was. It was way back before the winter solstice. Yes, it was right after the attack. The day you left with young Richard. Now, there was a nice boy, kind as a sunny day he was, always smiled at me with a how do you do. Most of the other boys don't even see me right there before their eyes, but young Richard always saw me, he did, and had a pleasant word for me, too.
Verna only half listened. She remembered the day Millie spoke of. She and Warren had gone with Richard to get him through the shield that kept him bound to the palace. After they passed through the shield, they went to the Baka Banmana people and took them all to the Valley of the Lost, their ancestral homeland. A homeland they had been driven from 3,000 years before, in order that the towers that separated the old from the new world be put up. Richard needed their spirit woman to help him. Richard had used unimaginable power, not only additive magic, but subtractive too, to destroy the towers and cleanse the valley, returning it to the Baka Banmana before he went on his desperate mission to stop the Keeper of the Dead from escaping through the gateway and into the world of the living. Winter solstice had come and gone, so she knew he had succeeded. Suddenly, Verna turned to Millie.
That was almost a month ago. Well, before she died.
Millie nodded.
That seems about right to me.
You mean to say that she gave you the ring almost 3 weeks before she died?
Millie nodded.
Why so long?
She said she wanted to give it to me before she slipped any further, and wouldn't be able to say goodbye to me, or be able to give proper instructions.
I see.
And when you went back after that, before she died, did she slip as she thought? Millie shrugged as she let out a sigh.
That was the only time I saw her. When I went back to see her and to clean, the guards said that Nathan and the prelate had left strict orders that no one was to be allowed in. Something about Nathan not being disturbed as he tried his best to heal her. I didn't want him to fail, so I tiptoed away, quiet as I could.
Verna sighed.
Well, thank you for telling me, Millie.
Verna glanced at her desk and the waiting stacks of reports.
I'd best be back at my work, too, or everyone will think me lazy.
Oh, that's a shame, prelate. Such a warm, beautiful night, you should enjoy your private garden.
Verna grunted. I've so much work to do, I've never even poked my nose out to look at the prelate's private garden. Millie started toward her bucket, but suddenly spun back.
Prelate, I just remembered something else that Anne told me.
Verna straightened her dress at her shoulders.
She told you something else? Something you told the others that you forgot to tell me?
No, prelate,
Millie whispered as she scurried closer.
No, she told me, and told me to tell none but the new prelate. For some reason, it's been completely out of my memory until this moment.
With all the rest, she may have spelled the message to make you forget it for all but the new prelate.
Oh, that could be,
Millie said as she rubbed her lip. She looked into Verna's eyes.
Anne would do things like that sometimes. Sometimes she could be devious.
Verna smiled without humor.
Yes, I know. I, too, have been on the receiving end of her manipulations. What is the message?
She said to tell you to be sure not to work too hard.
Verna rested a hand on a hip.
That's the message.
Millie nodded as she leaned close and lowered her voice.
And she said that you should use the garden to relax. But she took my arm and pulled me close then, looking right into my eyes, and told me to tell you also to be sure to visit the prelate's sanctuary.
Sanctuary? What sanctuary? Millie turned and pointed through the open doors.
Out in the garden there's a little building nestled in the trees and shrubs. She called it her sanctuary. I've never been in it. She never allowed me to go in there to clean. She cleaned it herself, she said, because a sanctuary was a sacrosanct place where a body could be alone and where no one else ever set foot. She would go there from time to time, I think, to pray for guidance from the Creator, or perhaps just to be alone. She said to be sure to tell you to go there and visit it.
Verna let out an exasperated breath.
Sounds like her way of telling me I would need the Creator's help to get through all the paperwork.
She did have a twisted sense of humor sometimes. Millie chuckled.
Yes, prelate. That she did, twisted.
Millie put her hands to her blushing cheeks.
May the Creator forgive me. She was a kind woman. Her humor was never meant to be hurtful.
No, I suppose not. Verna rubbed her temples as she started for her desk. She was tired and dreaded the prospect of reading more mind-numbing reports. She halted and turned back to Millie. The doors to the garden were opened wide, letting in the fresh night air.
Millie, it's late. Why don't you go have some dinner and get some rest?
Rest is good for tired bones. Millie grinned.
Really, prelate? You don't mind your office being layered in dirt?
Verna laughed under her breath.
Millie, I've been out of doors for so many years that I've grown fond of dirt. It's fine, really. Have a good rest.
As Verna stood in the doorway to her garden, looking out into the night, at moonlight-dappled ground beneath trees and vines, Millie gathered up her rags and bucket.
A good night to you, then, prelate. Enjoy your visit to your garden.
She heard the door close and the room fall silent. She stood feeling the warm, moist breeze and inhaled the fragrant aroma of leaf and flower and earth. Verna took a last look back at her office and then stepped out into the waiting night. Chapter 22. Verna took a deep, refreshing breath of the humid night air. It was like a tonic. She could feel her muscles relaxing as she strolled down a winding, narrow path among beds of peeping lilies, flowering dogwood and lush huckleberry bushes, as she waited for her eyes to adjust to the moonlight. Spreading trees reached over the dense shrubs, seeming to offer their branches for her to touch, or the sweet fragrance of their foliage and blossoms for her to inhale. Though it was too early for most trees to be in bloom, in the prelate's garden there were a few rare everblossoms, squat, gnarled, outspreading trees that bloomed throughout the year, though they fruited only in season. In the New World, she had come across a small forest of everblossoms, and discovered them to be a favorite haunt of the elusive night wisps, frail creatures appearing to be nothing more than sparks of light and only visible at night. After the night wisps had been convinced of their benign intentions, she and the two sisters she had been with at the time had spent several nights there, talking with the wisps of simple things and learning about the benevolent nature of the wizards and confessors who guided the Alliance of the Midlands. Verna had been pleased to learn that the people of the Midlands protected places of magic and left the creatures inhabiting them to live their lives in unmolested solitude. While there were wild places in the old world where magic creatures dwelled, they were nowhere near as numerous or as varied as those wondrous places in the New World. Verna had learned a bit of tolerance from some of those creatures, that the Creator had sprinkled the world with many fragile wonders, and sometimes mankind's highest calling was to simply let them be. In the old world, that view was not widely held, and there were many places where wild magic had been brought under control, lest people be injured or killed by things not amenable to reason. Magic could often be inconvenient. In many ways, the New World was still a wild place, as the old world had been thousands of years ago, before man made it a safe, if somewhat sterile, place through its notions of stewardship. Verna missed the New World. She had never felt so at home as she did there. Ducks, sleeping with their heads tucked back under their wings, bobbed at the edge of a pond beside the path, while unseen frogs croaked from the reeds. Verna saw an occasional fluttermouse swoop down across the surface of the water to snatch a bug from the air. Moon shadows played across the grassy bank as the gentle breeze caressed the trees overhead. Just beyond the pond, a small side trail turned off toward a stand of trees among a thicket of underbrush, hardly touched by the moonlight. Verna somehow felt this was the place she sought, and strolled off the main path toward the waiting shadows. The grounds here seemed to be ruled by the wildness of nature, as opposed to the cultured look of much of the garden. Through a narrow opening in the wall of Thorn Glove, Verna found an enchanting little stuccoed building with four gables, the rake of each tiled roof swooping down in a gentle curve to eaves no higher than her head. A towering maidenhair tree stood off the face of each gable, its branches lacing together overhead. Sweetbriar hugged the ground close to the walls, suffusing the cozy enclosure with a fragrant scent. A round window, too high to see through, was set in the peak of each gable. At one gabled wall, where the path ended, Verna found a rough-hewn, round-topped door with a sunburst pattern carved in its center. There was a pull handle, but no lock. A tug produced no movement, not even a wiggle. The door was shielded. Verna ran her fingers along the edge, feeling for the nature of the shield, or its keyway. She felt only an icy chill that made her recoil at its touch. She opened herself to her Han, letting the sweet light inundate her with its warm, familiar comfort. She nearly gasped with the glory of being just that much closer to the Creator. The air suddenly smelled of a thousand scents. Against her flesh it felt of moisture, dust, pollen, and salt from the ocean. In her ears it carried the sounds of a world of insects, small animals, and fragments of words carried for miles in its airy, volatile fingers. She listened carefully for any sounds that might betray anyone near, at least anyone with no more than additive magic. She heard none. Verna focused her Han on the door before her. Her probe told her that the entire building was encased in a web, but not one she had ever felt before. It had elements of ice woven through with spirit. She didn't even know ice could be woven with spirit. The two fought each other like cats in a sack, but there it was, the two of them purring contentedly, as if they belonged together. She had absolutely no idea how such a shield could be breached, much less undone. Still joined with her Han, an impulse came to her, and she reached up, touching the sunburst pattern on her ring to that on the door. The door swung silently open. Verna stepped inside and placed the ring on the sunburst pattern carved on the inside of the door. It obediently swung closed. With her Han, she could feel the shield seal tight around her. Verna had never felt so isolated, so alone, so safe. Candles sprang to flame. She surmised that they must be tied to the shield. Light from the 10 candles, 5 each in 2 candlesticks with branching arms, was more than sufficient to light the inside of the small sanctuary. The candlesticks stood to each side of a small altar, draped with a white cloth trimmed in gold thread. Atop the white cloth rested a perforated bowl, probably for burning aromatic gums. A red brocade kneeling pad, edged with gold tassels, sat on the floor before the altar. Each of the 4 alcoves formed by the gables was only large enough for the comfortable-looking chair occupying one of them. One of the others held the altar, another, a tiny table with a 3-legged stool, and the last, along with the door, a box bench with a neatly folded quilted comforter, probably for the lap, as lying down looked to be out of the question. The area in the center wasn't much larger than the alcoves. Verna turned about, wondering what it was she was supposed to do here. Prelate Annalena had left a message to make sure she visited the place, but why? What was she to accomplish here? She flopped down in the chair, her eyes searching the faceted walls that followed the in and out of the gable ends. Maybe she was supposed to come here to relax. Annalena knew the work of being prelate. Maybe she simply wanted her successor to know of a place where she could be alone, a place to get away from people always bringing her reports. Verna drummed her fingers on the arm of the chair. Not likely. She didn't feel like sitting. There were more important things to do. There were reports waiting, and they were hardly likely to begin reading themselves. Hand clasped behind her back, Verna paced as best she could around the tiny room. This was certainly a waste of time. She finally let out an exasperated breath and lifted her fist toward the door, but stopped before she touched the ring to the sunburst pattern. Verna turned back, staring for a moment, then lifted her skirts and knelt on the pad. Perhaps Annalena wanted her to pray for guidance. A prelate was expected to be a pious person. Although it was absurd to think one needed a special place to pray to the Creator had created everything. Everywhere was his special place. So why would one need a special place to seek guidance? A special place could never approach the meaningfulness of one's own heart. No place could compare to joining with her Han. With an irritated sigh, Verna folded her hands.
She waited, but wasn't in the mood to pray to the Creator in a place in which she was under obligation to do so. It vexed her to think that Annalena was dead, yet still manipulating her. Verna's eyes roved the bare walls as her toe tapped against the floor. The woman was reaching out from the world beyond to enjoy a final morsel of control. Hadn't she had enough of that in all the years she was prelate? One would think that would be enough, but no, she had to have it all planned out so that even after she was dead, she could still... Verna's eyes settled on the bowl. There was something in the bottom, and it wasn't ashes. She reached in and lifted out a small package, wrapped in paper and tied with a bit of string. She turned it over in her fingers, inspecting it. This had to be it. This had to be what she was sent here for. But why leave it in here? The shield. No one but the prelate could enter. This was the only place to put something if you didn't want anyone but the prelate to have it. Verna pulled the ends of the bow and dropped the string back in the bowl. Laying it in a palm, she lifted back the paper and stared at what was inside. It was a journey book. Finally, movement returned to her fingers, and she extracted the book from the paper to thumb through the pages. Blank. Journey books were objects of magic, like the Dakra, that had been created by the same wizards who had invested the Palace of the Prophets with both additive and subtractive magic. None since, for 3,000 years, except Richard, had been born with subtractive. Some had learned it through the calling, but none but Richard had been born with it. Journey books had the ability to transmit messages. What was written in one with a stylus, stored in the spine, would appear by magic in its twin. As near as they could determine, the message written in one appeared in the twin simultaneously. Since the stylus could also be used to wipe old messages away, the books were never used up and could be used over and over. They had been carried by sisters who went on journeys to recover boys born with the gift. More often than not, the sisters had had to travel through the barrier, through the Valley of the Lost, going into the New World to recover the boy and put a Radahan around his neck, so that the gift would not harm him while he learned to control his magic. Once beyond the barrier, there was no turning back for instructions or guidance. One journey through and back was all that was possible for each sister. Until now, Richard had destroyed the towers and their storms of spells. A young boy with no understanding of the gift could not control it, and his magic sent out telltale signs that could be detected by sisters at the palace, who were sensitive to such disturbances in the flows of power. Not enough sisters had this talent to risk sending them on journeys, so others were sent, and they carried a journey book to be able to communicate with the palace. If sisters were to go after the boy and something happened, he moved, for example, they would need guidance to find him in his new location. Of course, a wizard could teach the boy to control the gift in order to avoid its many dangers, and in fact, that was the preferred method. But wizards were not always available or willing. The sisters had long ago established an accord with the wizards in the New World. In the absence of a wizard, the Sisters of the Light were allowed to save a boy's life by taking him to the Palace of the Prophets for training in the use of his gift. For their part, sisters had vowed never to take a boy who had a wizard willing to teach him. It was a truce, backed by a death sentence to any sister who ever again entered the New World if the agreement were ever violated. Prelate Annalena had violated that agreement in order to bring Richard to the palace. Verna had been the unwitting instrument of the violation. At any one time, there could be several sisters gone on a journey to recover a boy. Verna had found a whole box of journey books back in her office, tied together in matching pairs. The journey books were twinned, each working only with its correct twin. Precautions were always taken before a journey was undertaken. The two books were taken to separate locations and tested, just to be sure a sister wasn't sent off with the wrong book. Journeys were dangerous. That was why the sisters also carried a Dakra up their sleeve. Usually a journey lasted a few months, and on rare occasions they had lasted as long as a year. Verna's journey had lasted over 20 years. Nothing like that had ever happened before, but then it had been 3,000 years since one like Richard had been born. Verna had lost 20 years she could never recover. She had aged in the outside world. The 20-odd years of aging her body had undergone would have taken near to 300 years at the Palace of the Prophets. She had not simply given up 20 years to go on Prelate Annalena's mission. She had, in reality, given up close to 300 years. Worse, Annalena had known all along where Richard was. Even though she had done as she had in order to allow the proper prophecies to come to pass so they could stop the Keeper, it hurt that she had never told Verna that she was being sent out to throw away that much of her life as a decoy. Verna reprimanded herself. She had not thrown anything away. She had been doing the Creator's work. Just because she hadn't known all the facts at the time made it no less important.
Many people toiled their whole lives at meaningless things. Verna had toiled at something that had saved the world of the living. Besides that, those 20 years were perhaps the best years of her life. She had been out in the world on her own, with 2 other sisters of the light, learning about strange places and strange peoples. She had slept under the stars, seen distant mountains, plains, rivers, rolling hills, villages, towns, and cities that few others had seen. She had made her own decisions and accepted the consequences. She had never had to read reports. She had lived the stuff of reports. No, she had not lost anything. She had gained more than any of the sisters sitting back here for 300 years would ever gain. Verna felt a tear drop under her hand. She reached up and wiped her cheek. She missed her journey. All that time she had thought she hated it, and only now did she realize how much it meant to her. She turned the journey book over in her trembling fingers, feeling the familiar size and weight, the familiar grain of the leather, the familiar 3 little bumps at the top of the front cover. She jerked the book up to her eyes, looking in the candlelight. The 3 bumps, deep scratch at the bottom of the spine, it was the same book. She couldn't mistake her journey book, not after carrying it for 20 years. It was the very same book. She had looked at all the books in the box in her office, absently searching for this one, and she had not found it. It had been here. But why? She held up the paper it had been wrapped in and saw there was writing on the paper. She held it near the candle in order to read it. "Guard this with your life." She turned the paper over, but that was all it said. "Guard this with your life." Verna knew the prelate's hand. When she had been on her journey to recover Richard, and after she had found him but was forbidden to interfere with him in any way, or to use his collar to help control him, yet was expected to bring him back a grown man, unlike any other they had ever recovered, she had sent an angry message to the palace. "I am the sister in charge of this boy. These directives are beyond reason, if not absurd. I demand to know the meaning of these instructions. I demand to know upon whose authority they are given." She had received back a message. "You will do as you are instructed or suffer the consequences. Do not presume to question the orders of the palace again. In my own hand, the prelate." The message of reprimand the prelate had sent her was burned in her memory. The handwriting was engraved in her memory. The hand on the piece of paper was the same. That message had been a thorn in her side, forbidding her to do the very thing she had been trained to do. It was only back at the palace that she discovered that Richard had subtractive magic, and had she used the collar, he would have very likely killed her. The prelate had been saving her life, but it nettled her that once again she had not been informed. Verna guessed that was what annoyed her the most, the prelate not telling her why. She understood, of course. There had been sisters of the dark at the palace, and the prelate could not take any risk or the whole world would be consumed. But emotionally it still vexed her. Reason and passion were not always in agreement. As prelate, she was coming to see that sometimes you couldn't convince people of the need of something, and the only option was simply to give an order. Sometimes you had to use people to do what must be done. Verna dropped the paper in the bowl and ignited it with a flow of Han. She watched it burn, just to be sure it was entirely reduced to ash. Verna squeezed the journey book, her journey book, tightly in her hand. It was good to have it back. Of course, it wasn't really hers, it belonged to the palace, but she had carried it so many years that it felt like hers, like an old, familiar friend. The thought struck her abruptly. Where was the other one? This book had a twin. Where was its twin? Who had it? She regarded the book with sudden trepidation. She was holding something potentially dangerous. And once again, Annalena was not telling her all of it. It was entirely possible that its twin was held by a sister of the dark. This could be Annalena's way of telling her to find its twin, and she would find a sister of the dark. But how? She couldn't simply write, "Who are you and where are you?" in the book. Verna kissed her ring finger, her ring, and then stood. "Guard this with your life." Journeys were dangerous. Sisters had been captured and on occasion killed by hostile peoples who were protected by magic of their own. In those instances, only her Dakra, a knife-like weapon with the ability to instantly extinguish life, could protect her if she were quick enough. Verna still had hers up her sleeve. On the back of her belt, Verna had long ago sewn a pouch to secrete the journey book and keep it safe. She slipped the little book into its glove-like pouch. Verna patted her belt. It felt good to have the journey book back there. "Guard this with your life. Dear Creator, who had the other?" When Verna burst through the door to her outer office, Sister Phoebe jumped up as if someone had stuck her in the rump with a sharp stick. Her round face went red.
"Prelate, you startled me. You weren't in your office. I thought you had gone to bed.
Verna's gaze swept the desk, scattered with reports.
I thought I told you that you had done enough work for one day and to go get some rest.
Phoebe twisted her fingers together as she winced.
You did, but I remembered some tallies I had forgotten to verify, and I was afraid you would see them and call me to account, so I ran back to check the numbers.
Verna had somewhere to go, but rethought how she had planned to go about it. She clasped her hands.
Phoebe, how would you like to do a task that Prelate Annalena always trusted to her administrators?
Sister Phoebe's fingers stilled.
Really? What is it?
Verna gestured back toward her office.
I've been out in my garden praying for guidance, and it has come to me that in these trying times I should consult the prophecies.
Whenever Prelate Annalena did the same, she always had her administrators clear the vaults so that she wouldn't feel encumbered by prying eyes watching what she read. How would you like to order the vaults cleared for me, like her administrators did for her? The young woman bounced on the balls of her feet.
Really, Verna? That would be splendid.
Young woman indeed, Verna thought in annoyance. They were the same age, even if they didn't look it.
Let's be off, then. I have palace business to attend to.
Sister Phoebe snatched up her white shawl, throwing it over her shoulders as she bolted through the door.
Phoebe,
the round face peeked back around the doorframe.
If Warren is in the vaults, have him stay. I have a few questions, and he would be better able to direct me to the proper volumes than any of the others would. It will save me time. All right, Verna,
Phoebe said in a breathless voice. She liked doing paperwork, probably because it made her feel useful, in a way she never would have until she had acquired another 100 years of experience. But Verna had cut that time short by appointing her the prelate's administrator. The prospect of wielding orders, though, seemed to be of even more interest than paperwork.
I'll run ahead and have them cleared by the time you get there,
she grinned.
I'm glad it was me here instead of Dulcinea.
Verna remembered how she and Phoebe used to be of such like personalities. Verna wondered if she really had such an immature temperament when Annalena sent her on her journey. It seemed to her that in the years she had been gone, she had grown older than Phoebe in more than just appearance. Perhaps she had simply learned more out in the world, rather than in the cloistered life of the Palace of the Prophets. Verna smiled.
Almost seems like one of our old pranks, doesn't it?
Phoebe giggled.
Sure does, Verna. Except it won't end in us stringing 1,000 prayer beads.
She dashed off down the hall, her skirts and shawl flapping behind. By the time Verna had made it down into the heart of the palace, to the huge, round, 6-foot-thick stone door leading into vaults carved from the bedrock atop which sat the palace, Phoebe was just leading 6 sisters, 2 novices and 3 young men out. Novices and young men were given lessons at all hours of the day and night. Sometimes they were even awakened in the dead of night for lessons, such as ones down in the vaults. The Creator didn't keep hours. They were expected to learn that in his work they didn't either. They all bowed as one.
The Creator's blessing on you, Verna said to them as a group.
She was about to apologize for chasing them from the vaults when they were busy, but she cut herself off, reminding herself that she was the prelate and didn't need to make excuses to anyone. The prelate's word was law and was followed without question. Still, it was hard not to explain herself.
All clear, prelate,
Sister Phoebe said in an august tone. Phoebe inclined her head toward the room beyond.
Except the one you asked to see. He's in one of the small rooms.
Verna nodded to her assistant and then turned her attention to the novices, who were in a state of wide-eyed awe.
And how are your studies coming?
Trembling like leaves on a quaking aspen, both girls curtsied, one swallowed.
Very well, prelate, she squeaked, her face going red.
Verna remembered the first time the prelate had addressed her directly. It had seemed as if the Creator himself had spoken. She remembered how much the prelate's smile had meant to her, how it had sustained and inspired her. Verna squatted down and in each arm hugged the girl to herself. She kissed each forehead.
If you ever have a need, don't be afraid to come to me. That's what I'm here for. And I love you like all the Creator's children.
Both girls beamed and performed curtsies more steady the second time. Their round eyes stared at the gold ring on her finger. As if it had reminded them, they each kissed their own ring finger, whispering a prayer to the Creator. Verna did the same. Their eyes widened at the sight. She held her hand out.
Would you like to kiss the ring that symbolizes the light we all follow?
They nodded earnestly, going to a knee in turns to kiss the sunburst pattern ring. Verna squeezed each small shoulder.
What are your names?
Helen, prelate, one said.
Valerie, prelate,
the other said.
Helen and Valerie.
Verna didn't need to remind herself to smile.
Remember, novices Helen and Valerie, that while there are others, such as the sisters, who know more than you and will teach you many things, there is no one closer to the Creator than you, not even me. We are all his children. Verna felt more than a little uncomfortable being the object of veneration, but she smiled and waved as the group headed off down the stone hall. After they had rounded a corner, Verna pressed her hand to the cold metal plate set in the wall, the plate that was the keyway to the shield guarding the vaults. The ground shook beneath her feet as the huge, round door began to move. It was rare for the main vault door to be closed, except under special circumstances. Only the prelate ever sealed the entrance. She stepped into the vault as the door grated closed behind her, leaving her in tomb-like silence. Verna passed the old, worn tables with papers scattered all over them, along with some of the simpler books of prophecy. The sisters had been giving lessons. The lamps set about the carved stone walls did little to diminish a feeling of perpetual night. Long rows of bookcases stretched off to either side among massive pillars supporting the vaulted ceiling. Warren was in one of the back rooms. The small, hollowed-out alcoves were restricted, and so had separate doors and shields. The room he was in was one with the oldest prophecies written in High Dahiran. Few people knew High Dahiran, among them Warren and Verna's predecessor. When she stepped into the lamplight, Warren slouched against the table with his arms folded atop it, only glanced up. "Phoebe told me you wanted to use the vaults," he said in a distracted voice. "Warren, I need to talk to you. Something has happened." He flipped a page in the book before him. He didn't look up.
Yes, all right."
She frowned and then drew a chair to the table beside him, but didn't sit. With a flick of her wrist, Verna brought a dakra to her left hand. The dakra, with a silver rod in place of a blade, was used the same as a knife, but it wasn't the wound it caused that killed. The dakra was a weapon possessing ancient magic. Used in conjunction with the wielder's han, it drained the life force from the victim, regardless of the nature of the wound. There was no defense against its magic. Warren looked up with tired, red eyes as she leaned closer. "Warren, I want you to have this."
"That's a weapon of the sisters."
"You have the gift. It will work for you as well as me."
"What do you want me to do with it?"
"Protect yourself." He frowned.
"What do you mean?"
"The sisters of the..." She glanced back into the main room. Even if it was empty, there was no telling how far one with subtractive magic could hear. They had heard Prelate Annalena name them.
"You know,"
she lowered her voice.
"Warren, though you have the gift, it will not protect you against them. This will. There is no protection against this. None."
She spun the weapon in her hand with practiced grace, walking it over the backs of her fingers as it twirled. The dull silver color was a blur in the lamplight. She caught the rod-like blade and held the handle out to him.
"I found extras in my office. I want you to have one."
He flipped his hand dismissively.
"I don't know how to handle that thing. I only know how to read the old books."
Verna snatched his violet robes at his neck and drew his face close.
"You just stick it in them. Belly, chest, back, neck, arm, hand, foot, it doesn't matter. Just stick them while you're shrouded in your han, and they will be dead before you can blink."
"My sleeves aren't tight like yours. It will just fall out." "Warren, the dakra doesn't know where you keep it or care. Sisters practice for hours on end and carry them in our sleeves so they will be readily at hand. We do that for protection when we go on journeys. Doesn't matter where you carry it, only that you do. Keep it in a pocket if you wish. Just don't sit on it." With a sigh, he took the dakra.
"If it will make you happy, but I don't think I could stab anyone."
She released his robes as she looked away.
"You would be surprised what you can do when you have to."
"Is this what you came for? You found an extra dakra?"
"No."
She drew the little book from its pouch behind her belt and tossed it on the table before him.
"I came because of this."
He glanced at her out of the corner of his eye.
"Going somewhere, Verna?"
Scowling, she smacked his shoulder.
"What's the matter with you?"
He pushed the book away.
"I'm just tired. What's so important about a journey book?"
She lowered her voice.
"Prelate Annalena left a message that I should go to her private sanctuary in her garden. It was shielded with a web of ice and spirit."
Warren lifted an eyebrow. She showed him her ring.
"This opens it. Inside I found this journey book. It was wrapped in a piece of paper that said only, 'Guard this with your life.'"
Warren picked up the journey book and thumbed through the blank pages.
"She probably just wants to send you instructions."
"She's dead." Warren cocked an eyebrow.
"Do you think that would stop her?"
Verna smiled in spite of herself.
"Maybe you're right.
Maybe we burned the other with her, and she intended to run my life from the world of the dead.
Warren's expression slipped back to sullen.
So, who has the other one?
Verna smoothed her dress behind her knees and sat, scooting the chair closer.
I don't know.
I'm worried that it could be a telltale of sorts. She might have meant to mean that if I discovered the other, it would identify our enemy.
Warren's smooth brow wrinkled up.
That doesn't make any sense. Why would you think that?
I don't know, Warren. Verna wiped a hand across her face. It was the only thing I could think of. Can you think of anything that would make more sense?
Why else would she not tell me who had the other?
If it was someone meant to help us, someone on our side, then it would only make sense for her to have told me the name, or at least that it was a friend who had the other.
Warren returned his stare to the table.
I suppose.
Verna checked her tone before she spoke.
Warren, what's wrong? I've never seen you like this before.
She shared a long look with his troubled blue eyes.
I've read some prophecies I don't like.
Verna searched his face.
What do they say?
After a long pause, he reached down and with two fingers turned a piece of paper around and pushed it toward her. Finally, she picked it up and read it aloud.
When the prelate and the prophet are given to the light in a sacred rite, the flames will bring to boil a cauldron of guile and give ascension to a false prelate who will reign over the death of the palace of the prophets. To the north, the one bonded to the blade will abandon it for the silver slif, for he will breathe her back to life, and she will deliver him into the arms of the wicked.
Verna swallowed, afraid to meet Warren's eyes. She set the paper on the table and folded her hands in her lap to stop their trembling. She sat silently staring down, not knowing what to say.
This is a prophecy on a true fork, Warren said at last.
That's an audacious statement, Warren, even for one as talented with prophecies as you. How old is this prophecy?
Not yet a day.
Her wide eyes came up.
What?
She whispered.
Warren, are you saying that it came to you? That you have at last given a prophecy?
Warren's red eyes stared back.
Yes. I went into a kind of trance, and in this state of rapture, I had a vision of fragments of this prophecy, along with the words. That was the way it happened for Nathan, too, I believe. Remember that I told you I was beginning to understand prophecy in a way I never had before? It's through the visions that the prophecies are truly meant to be revealed.
Verna swept her hand around.
But the books hold prophecies, not visions. The words prophesy.
The words are only a way to pass them down, and only meant to be clues that trip the vision in one who has the gift for prophecy. All the studying the sisters have done for the last 3,000 years is only a partial understanding of them. The written words were meant to pass knowledge to wizards through the visions. That's what I learned when this one came to me. It was like a door opening in my mind. All this time, and the key was right inside my own head.
You mean you can read any of these and have a vision that will reveal its true meaning?
He shook his head.
I'm a child who has taken his first step. I have a long way to go before I'll be vaulting over fences.
She looked at the page on the table, and then glanced away as she twisted the ring around and around on her finger.
And does this one, the one that came to you, mean what it sounds like?
Warren licked his lips.
Like an infant's first step, which is not very steady, this is not the most stable of prophecies. You might say it's sort of a practice prophecy. I found others that I think are the same sort of first attempts like this one here.
Warren, is it true or not?
He tugged his sleeves down his arms.
It's all true, but the words, as in all prophecies, while true, are not necessarily what they would seem.
Verna leaned close as she gritted her teeth.
Answer the question, Warren. We're in this together, I have to know.
He flipped his hand, as he often did when trying to diminish the importance of something.
To Verna, though, that flip of a hand was like a flag of warning.
Look, Verna, I'll tell you what I know, what I saw in the vision, but I'm new at this, and I don't understand it all, even though it's my prophecy.
She kept a steady glare on him.
Tell me, Warren. The prelate in the prophecy is not you. I don't know who it is, but it isn't you.
Verna closed her eyes as she sighed.
Warren, that's not as bad as I thought. At least it's not to be me who does this terrible thing. We can work to turn this prophecy to a false fork.
Warren looked away. He stuffed the paper with his prophecy into an open book and flopped it closed.
Verna, for someone else to be prelate, that has to mean you will be dead.
Chapter 23.
When his whole body suddenly flushed with the sweet agony of desire, he knew, even though he couldn't see her, that she had entered the room. His nostrils filled with her unmistakable scent, and already he ached to surrender. Like a furtive movement in the mist, he couldn't discern the essence of the threat, but somehow in the dim recesses of his awareness, he knew without doubt that there was one, and the exquisite peril too excited him. With the desperation of a man being stormed by an overpowering foe, he clawed for the hilt of his sword, hoping to rally his resolve and stay the hand of submission. It wasn't bared steel he sought, though, but the bared teeth of anger, a rage that would sustain him and give him the will to resist. He could do it. He had to. Everything turned on this. His hand anchored on the hilt at his belt, and he felt the flood of perfect fury coursing through his body and mind. When Richard glanced up, he could see the approach of Ulick and Egan's heads above the knot of people before him. Even if he hadn't seen them, to see the space between them where she would be, he knew she was there. Soldiers and dignitaries began parting to make way for the two big men and their charge. Heads tilted in waves, reminding him of the rings of ripples in a pond. As they passed whispers to others, Richard recalled that the prophecies had also named him the pebble in the pond, the generator of ripples in the world of life. And then he saw her, his chest constricted with longing. She was wearing the same rose-colored silk dress that she had worn the night before, having no change of clothes with her. Richard recalled vividly how she had said she slept naked. He could feel his heart hammering. With great effort, he struggled to put his mind to the task at hand. She looked with wide eyes at the soldiers she knew. They were her Keltish palace guard. Now they wore Daharan uniforms. Richard had been up early preparing everything. He hadn't been able to get much sleep anyway, and the sleep he had gotten had been racked with dreams of longing. "Kaelin, my love, can you ever forgive me my dreams?" With this many Daharan troops in Adendrill, he had known there would be supplies of all sorts available, so he had ordered spare uniforms brought out. The Keltans, being disarmed as they were in no position to argue, but after they had put on the dark leather and mail, and had had a chance to see how fierce they looked in the new outfits, they began to grin with approval. They were told that Kelton was now a part of Dahara, and were given back their weapons. They stood in rank now, proud and straight, as they kept an eye on the representatives of the other lands who had yet to surrender. As it had turned out, the bad luck of the storm that had allowed Brogan to escape had also carried good fortune as a balance. The dignitaries had wanted to wait out the foul weather before departing, so Richard had taken what the fates had offered him and had brought them back to the palace before they were to leave later that morning. Only the highest, the most important of those officials were present. He wanted them to witness the surrender of Kelton, one of the most powerful lands of the Midlands. He wanted them to have one final lesson. Richard stood as Catherine started up the steps at the side of the dais, her gaze sweeping the faces watching her. Verdeen stepped back to give her room. Richard had positioned the three Mordsith at the far ends of the platform, where they wouldn't be too close to him. He wasn't interested in anything they might have to say. When Catherine's brown-eyed gaze finally settled on him, he had to lock his knees to keep his legs from buckling. His left hand, gripping the hilt of his sword, was beginning to throb. He reminded himself that he didn't need to be holding the sword to command its magic, and chanced removing his hand to wiggle some feeling back into his fingers while he contemplated the tasks before him. When the Sisters of the Light had tried to teach him to touch his Han, they had had him use a mental picture to concentrate his inner will. Richard had selected an image of the Sword of Truth to be his focus, and he had it firmly fixed in his mind now. But for the battle with the people gathered before him today, his sword would be of no use. Today he would need the deft maneuvers devised with the aid of General Rybish, his officers, and knowledgeable members of the palace staff, who had also helped with the arrangements. He hoped he had it all right.
"Richard, what?"
"Welcome, Duchess. Everything has been prepared." Richard scooped up her hand and kissed it in a manner he judged befitting a queen being greeted before an audience, but touching her only fired his heat. "I knew you would want these representatives to witness your bravery at being the first to join with us against the Imperial Order, the first to break the path for the Midlands."
"But I... well, yes, of course."
He turned to the watching faces. They were a considerably more quiet and compliant group than they had been the last time, as they waited in tense anticipation. "Duchess Lumholtz, whom you all know is soon to be named Queen of Kelton, has committed her people to the cause of freedom.
and wished you to be here to witness as she signs the documents of surrender.
Richard, she whispered as she leaned a little closer. I must have them looked over by our barristers first, just to be sure everything is clear and there will be no misunderstandings.
Richard smiled reassuringly.
Though I'm sure you will find them quite clear. I've already anticipated your concern and took the liberty of inviting them to the signing.
Richard held a hand out to the other end of the dais. Reyna seized a man's arm and urged him up the steps.
Master Seifold, would you give your future queen your professional opinion?
He bowed.
As Lord Rawl says, Duchess, the papers are quite clear. There is no room for misinterpretation.
Richard lifted the ornately decorated document from the desk.
With your permission, Duchess, I would like to read it to the gathered representatives, so they may see that Kelton wishes this joining of our forces to be unequivocal, so they may see your bravery.
Her head rose with pride before the eyes of the representatives of the other lands.
Yes, please do, Lord Rawl.
Richard glanced to the waiting faces.
Please bear with me, this isn't long.
He held the paper up before himself and read it aloud.
Know all peoples that Kelton hereby surrenders unconditionally to Dahara. Signed in my hand as the duly appointed leader of the Keltish people, the Duchess Lumholtz.
Richard set the document back on the desk and dunked the quill pen in a bottle of ink before offering it to Catherine. She stood stiff and unmoving, her face had gone ashen. Fearing she would balk, he had no choice. Summoning strength he knew he was stealing from what he would need later, he put his lips close to her ear, enduring silently the tortuous wave of longing in the warm fragrance of her flesh.
Catherine, after we finish here, would you go for a walk with me, just the two of us, alone? I dreamed of nothing but you.
Radiant color bloomed in her cheeks. He thought she might put an arm around his neck and thanked the spirits when she didn't.
Of course, Richard, she whispered back. I, too, dreamed of nothing but you. Let's get this formality over with. Make me proud of you, of your strength.
Richard thought that surely her smile would make others in the room blush. He could feel his ears burn at the meaning her smile conveyed. She took the quill pen, brushing his hand as she did so, and held it up.
I sign this surrender with a quill from a dove, to signify that what I do is done willingly, in peace, and not as one defeated. I do it out of love for my people, and a hope for the future. That hope is this man here, Lord Rawl. I swear the undying vengeance of my people on any of you who would think to harm him.
She bent and scrawled her sweeping signature across the bottom of the surrender document. Before she could straighten, Richard produced more papers and slid them under her.
What? The letters you spoke of, Duchess.
I didn't want to weigh you down with the tedium of having to do the work yourself when we could put the time to a better purpose.
Your aides helped me draw them up. Please check them just to be sure all is as you intended when you made the offer last night.
Lieutenant Harrington of your palace guard helped with the names of General Baldwin, commander of all Keltish forces, Division Generals Cutter, Leiden, Nesbitt, Bradford, and Emerson, and a few of the guard commanders. There's a letter to each for you to sign, ordering them to turn over all command to my Daharan officers. Some of your palace guard officers will accompany a detachment of my men along with the new officers. Your adjutant aide, Master Montleon, has been of invaluable assistance with the instructions to Finance Minister Pelletier, Master Carlyle, the Deputy Administrator of Strategic Planning, the Governors in charge of the Trade Commission, Cameron, Tuck, Spooner, Ashmore, as well as Levertson, Dudier, and Falkingham of the Office of Commerce. Co-Adjutant Schaefer, of course, drew up the list of your mayors. We didn't want to offend anyone by leaving them out, of course, so he had several aides help him work up a complete list. There are letters here for them all, but of course the letters of instruction are the same, with just the proper name to each, so you only have to check over one and then just sign the rest. We'll handle it from there. I have men ready to ride with the official document pouches. A man from your guard will accompany each just to make sure there's no confusion. We have all the men from your guard here to witness your signature. Richard drew a breath and straightened as Catherine, still holding the pen in midair, blinked at all the papers Richard had pushed before her. Her aides had all come up to surround her, proud of the job they had accomplished in such short order. Richard leaned close to her again.
I hope I got it all as you wished, Catherine. You said you'd take care of it, but I didn't want to be away from you while you toiled at the work, so I rose early and took care of it for you. I hope you're pleased.
She glanced over letters, pushing them aside to look at others underneath.
Yes, of course.
Richard slid a chair closer. Why don't you have a seat? When she had sat and started signing her name, Richard pushed his sword out of the way and sat beside her, in the mother confessor's chair. He settled his gaze on the people watching, and kept it there as he listened to the pen scratching. He kept the rage on a slow boil in order to concentrate. Richard turned back to the smiling Celtish officials behind, and to each side of her chair. You've all performed a valuable service this morning, and I would be honored if you would be willing to continue in an official capacity. I'm sure I could use your talents in administering the growing Dahara. After they had all bowed and thanked him for his generosity, he once again turned his attention to the silent group watching the proceedings. The Daharan soldiers, especially the officers, having spent months stationed in Adendril, had learned a great deal about trade in the Midlands. In the 4 days he had been with them searching for Brogan, Richard had learned all he could, and had added to that knowledge earlier that morning. When he knew the questions to ask, Mistress Sanderholt had proven to be a woman of vast knowledge, gathered over years of having prepared the dishes of many lands. Food, as it turned out, was a reservoir of knowledge about a people. Her keen ear didn't hurt either. Some of the papers the Duchess is signing are trade instructions, Richard told the officials as Catherine bent over her work. His eyes lingered on her shoulders. He willed them away. Since Kelton is now part of Dahara, you must understand that there can be no trade between Kelton and those of you who have not joined with us. He turned his gaze on a short, round man with a curly black and gray beard. I realize, Representative Garthram, that this will put Liffany in an uncomfortable position. With Galia and Kelton's borders now ordered sealed to anyone not part of Dahara, you will have a very difficult time with trade. With Galia and Kelton to your north, Dahara to your east, and the Rang Shaddaa Mountains to the west, you will be hard-pressed to find a source of iron. Most of what you purchased came from Kelton, and they bought grain from you. But Kelton will just have to buy their grain from the Galian warehouses now. Since they're now both Daharan, there is no longer any reason for past animosity to hinder trade, and their armies are under my command, so they won't be wasting effort worrying about one another and instead will devote their attention to sealing the borders. Dahara, of course, has a use for Celtish iron and steel. I suggest you find another source, and quickly, as the Imperial Order will probably attack from the south, possibly right through Liffany, I would suspect. I will have no man spilling blood to protect lands not yet joined with us, nor will I reward hesitation with trade privileges. Richard turned his gaze to a tall, gaunt man with a ring of wispy white hair around the base of his knobby skull. Ambassador Bezencourt, I regret to inform you that the letter here to Kelton's Commissioner Cameron instructs him that all agreements with your homeland of Sandiria are hereby cancelled until and unless you two are part of Dahara. When spring comes, Sandiria will not be allowed to drive their herds up from your plains to spring and summer on the highlands of Kelton. The tall man lost what little color he had to begin with. But, Lord Rawl, we have no place to spring and summer them. While those plains are a lush grassland in the winter, they are a brown and barren wasteland in the summer. What would you have us do? Richard shrugged. I would suppose you'll have to slaughter your herds in order to salvage what you can before they starve. The ambassador gasped. Lord Rawl, these agreements have been in place for centuries. Our whole economy is based on the husbandry of our sheep. Richard lifted an eyebrow. It's not my concern. My concern is with those who stand with us. Ambassador Bezencourt raised his hands in an imploring gesture. Lord Rawl, my people would be ruined. Our whole country would be devastated if we were forced to slaughter our herds. Representative Thorault took an urgent step forward. You can't allow those herds to be slaughtered. Hirschborg depends on that wool. Why, it would ruin our industry. Another spoke up. And then they couldn't trade with us, and we would have no way to buy crops that won't grow in our land. Richard leaned forward. Then I suggest you impress these arguments on your leaders, and do your best to convince them that surrender is the only way. The sooner, the better. He looked out at the other dignitaries. As interdependent as you all are, I'm sure you will soon come to realize the value of unity. Kelton is part of Dahara now. The trade routes will be closed to any who fail to stand with us. I told you before, there are no bystanders.